Hello and welcome to episode 32 of the Capital Spotlight podcast, hosted by yours truly, Craig McGrother, the Director of Business Development at Lone Star Capital, with the one, the only, the man, the myth, and certainly the legend, Mr. Suit Supply himself, Mr. Patek Philippe. Haven't said that intro in a minute, but here we are. Rob Beardsley, how are you today, sir?
I'm good. I'm good. Let's rip this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, I know your little time constraints. We want to be very solid on our timing to make sure we don't go over so you don't miss any of your precious and important meetings. Quick little update here on the Lone Star Capital front. Yes, we are still working through San Antonio and Aspire. We don't have any more room for capital raising partners on this opportunity, but I think there's a little bit of room for some smaller, check sizes to potentially come into this deal. So reach out to me with any updates and availability regarding this deal. And if you are a fund manager, if you have a 1031 exchange coming up, if you're a capital raising partner or a joint venture equity partner who's looking to get in touch with a group like Lone Star Capital, if you like what we're doing here, please reach out to me. You know my email, but once more, for the billionth time, it's Craig, Craig, at lscre.com. If you have any questions pertaining to Lone Star Capital, if you want to reach out, you want to send us an email, if you have a question for the show, we've had a lot of questions I've actually just answered directly via email for specific questions. Someone asked about the European split and how the waterfall would work if we had a American kind of syndication style. I was like, well, I don't think that'd be the most beneficial because the double taxation and the benefit kind of goes away from the real estate when, if your country doesn't recognize bonus depreciation. So kind of went through some of that fun stuff there. But nonetheless, if you have any questions, if you need anything at all for myself, or if you have a question for Rob specifically, I'll gatekeep it. I'll try to get the information to you quickly. So there is that pertaining to the San Antonio Aspire deal and every other deal we have coming up in the pipeline. We do have some very interesting deals coming up. Also, this will be airing on Monday, which is the start of NMHC, which is exciting. Hopefully, we'll have a great episode recapping that. If you are also in the Orange County area or Los Angeles area, we are also hosting a mixer on February 1st, which is a Thursday, the first of the month, in Newport. If you are an LP, an accredited investor, a potential capital raiser who listens to the show and would like to meet me and Rob and a couple members of the team, we're also going to be hosting a fireside chat, which should be fun. So if you want to be a part of that and enjoy a happy hour on Lone Star Capital, email me once more. It's Craig at lscre.com. Really looking forward to NMHC. We've got an incredible lineup of meetings set up. Our schedule is basically, I mean, we don't have any more overlapping time left, which is a good thing. So we have done a very good job of being proactive about being strategic and intentional, and we're getting the best equity meetings lined up. So I'm absolutely thrilled for that. As you know, I did not like NMHC last year, but I am going in with a new enthusiastic attitude that's just, very, very positive and optimistic. So I did not think I'd be saying that last year, but here we are today. So.
NMHC is what you make of it. I remember I was showing you that picture, that old picture, our first NMHC. I
Can you
showed
pull it
up.
up?
Can I pull it up? Maybe I'll be able to find
Yeah,
it.
you can. You can. Or I'll
When
pull it up on my phone. How about that?
Sure,
You
yeah.
go.
Let's see. So when I first did my first NMHC, I show up and I see this sea of navy and gray suits, and everyone's rushing to meetings. And I'm thinking, gosh, how are these people all so dialed in? How do they have meetings scheduled? Like, how do they know to meet each other? What's going on? And then I come to find out that people schedule meetings at NMHC a month or two in advance, and that I've just came completely unprepared. Yeah, there you go. Perfect.
For
That's
those who are listening only, apologize for the bad radio. Why don't you tune into YouTube and subscribe and like the channel right now just to be able to get to see this incredible video? Don't mind the glare here. Oh, better there. But there is the young Rob Beardsley before he wrote his two incredible books. Before we had a $500 million of assets under management, he was just a.
Before I could afford nice ties.
Exactly. And, the suit, you can't tell here, but it's. Checked. There's a little pattern to it. The hair looked closer to my hair about 6 months ago. And this video here, we've come a long way since then, huh?
That's a long way. That's a long way.
Ooh, bonus picture.
Yes, bonus picture, me and Kent
Here
at
is
NMHC.
with Kent, the person that no one speaks with on the team, or sorry, this person that no one speaks with or has spoken with or heard from on the show who listens. Maybe at some point we'll get a celebrity appearance from Kent, the incredible other principal and founder of the firm. But fun little throwback right there. Moving on to the first topic of the day that I want to speak about, and this is actually a fun change that Lone Star just added, is preferred return or cruel start and pref misconceptions. So Rob, why don't you lead the way and educate everyone as to the updates with Lone Star Capital here, the significance of this, and why we switched from the old way to the new way. And if you want to explain what that is, fire away.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting. We just made the decision to change the way that we treat our preferred return accrual start date. So, firstly, this can be a little bit of a meaty topic because preferred returns actually really aren't as simple as they might be explained to somebody at first glance. And so, we'll dive into all those nuances. But the exciting news is that we've changed our policy that when an investor funds, let's say an investor is investing 100,000 or whatever the amount is. When they fund and we receive those funds, that's when their pref clock, if you will, begins accruing. So the way that our partnership structures work and how the vast majority of private equity and real estate investment partnership structures work is there's a preferred return, which is a minimum return that is owed to the investor before we, as the sponsor, earn any carried interest or promote. But there's, of course, all these nuances. Is the preferred return cumulative and compounding? Is it subject to return of capital when you're talking about cash flow distributions? And then, specifically to this conversation, when does the preferred return actually begin? So, previously, we just made it simple and we made the preferred return clock start when we close. So, if an investor funds on January 5th, but then we close on January 27th, nothing happens for their capital account until the 27th. On the 27th, that's the day that their pref clock starts accruing. So if they have an 8% preferred return, they're going to now start being owed. There's not even any air quotes. They are literally owed that 8% minimum return. The reason why I say air quotes is because a huge myth and misconception about preferred returns is people think that, oh, well, this deal has an 8% preferred return. That means I'm owed 8% cash distributions every single month. And
I
then when
literally
they.
just made that note there, by the way, and to get through, just to debunk that myth there, preferred return and cash on cash return are not the same thing. Sorry for my interjection, but I
No,
had to get
that's
it out
fine.
there.
Yes, they are not the same thing. And we can say it here, and we've said it before, and we'll say it again until we're blue in the face because it just is a very common misconception. And it's wishful thinking, right? Investors want to, well, but here's the thing also. The reason why this misconception exists is because preferred returns have been around 8% for a long time in this business. And prior to the market really overheating and going crazy, 8% cash on cash was a fairly achievable target. So what sponsors would do is they would make their lives easy on themselves and they would basically just say, hey, the preferred return is 8, and then they would just kick out 8% cash on cash distributions every month or quarter, and investors and they would just have o extra that they would perhaps keep in reserves or whatever, and everyone's happy. But then the market got really competitive in 18, 19, 20, things just went nuts in 21, 22. And cash on cash returns were way below 8. In year one, it might be 2%, 3%, 4%. And at that point, there's a big difference between cash on cash and preferred return. So if an investor who isn't really looking at the docs closely invests in a deal where they are owed an 8% preferred return, but the year one cash on cash is only 4, they get that first monthly check in the mail. They crunch the numbers on that. They go, wait, this annualizes to 4. Where's my 8? And then there's a problem. So that's the biggest misconception about preferred return, which, yes, we just need to belabor that point, frankly, because it is a misconception and people need to understand it. But going back to our point about the pref clock, the reason why we're implementing it such that an investor's preferred return begins accruing on their funding date is we want to, it's pretty straightforward. We want to incentivize investors to fund early. Rather than if an investor's preferred return is not going to begin accruing until the closing date anyway, then an investor's incentive is to delay funding as long as possible while still getting in the deal. Obviously, if they wait too long, then the deal oversubscribes and there's no room for them anymore. And then they're mad at us Right. And so it's no good either way, right? We're the
It's a
bad guy either
balancing
way.
act. Yeah,
It
it's
is
the
a
balancing
balancing
act
act.
too, because as we all know, anyone who's on the operating side who has to do fundraising, or if you're a capital raiser, fund manager, co-GP partner, and you're raising a tranche for a specific deal, you'll know that some people like to wait for the last minute because that's their prerogative. But on our end, it makes things a lot more challenging to figure out who's really in, who's really out. So this really incentivizes all people. It streamlines our operations. It holds our feet to the fire more to, distribute cash quickly and to account for all the equity necessary to close the deal.
Yeah, and for us, it's better to have capital in earlier because, like you said, it lets us know who's really in. And if we do have a shortfall or something, or somebody ends up backing out, it's much better to know that a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before closing than a day or two before closing. So,
Oh, yeah. Although I would say the interesting nature to the Fund of Fund program that we're obviously implementing heavily, that's been there before, though, is that unfortunately it is just one check coming into the deal. So we want to get them in as quickly as possible into our deal, but there's now a layer of separation now into our systems than there was there before. So I'm curious to know how we're going to work around that to incentivize. Obviously, I'm sure you and Dasha are figuring out a solution that makes sense for all parties there to make sure the equity is there, not, the day of funding, but ideally a week or two before.
Yeah, I mean you obviously are plugged into our process, and it's all about communication. That's what it comes down to. Theoretically, if there's trust and communication, then we can live in with a scenario in which an investor doesn't fund until a day before closing with enough trust and communication. But the reality is, when you have a big syndication and you have 100 investors, it's just not smart to bank on trust and communication across the board. But if you have a couple big investors that we've worked with before, and they're good for it, and they're funding 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10. For them, it's much prefer. We know the money's coming, so it's preferable for them to fund at the last minute. Because there's always moving parts when you're talking about that big sum of money. They don't want to just have to sell securities or move money around and have it sitting around not doing too much. But fortunately, at least for right now, interest is fairly substantial. So we're able to, when we do receive investor funds prior to closing, they're not just sitting in a bank account doing nothing. Now we can actually have them working at 5% plus in a treasury fund. So that's a big level up. So yeah, I mean, it's a pretty smart thing, I think. It's a no-brainer, but it's not standard, at least for syndications. In the joint venture world, it is more standard that a capital partner begins their preferred return accrual upon their contribution date. That is more standard in the institutional side. And that speaks to kind of all the different tidbits from the institutional world that we've taken and applied across the board, to all of our investors. So that's, for example, our preferred return is compounding and subject to return of capital, which is rare for syndication. Most people who have the opportunity to invest in a syndication with a $50,000 minimum, it usually is a non-compounding preferred return. There's usually a cash flow promote, which is not as favorable to investors. And also the fund and the preferred return clock starts at closing rather than upon funding. So yeah, that's a nice update. And then of course that myth busting and going over that. It's always a scary thing because we don't want to be the bearer of bad news to an investor who thought they were going to be getting 8%, and then perhaps the first year distribution is only 5%.
I make it abundantly clear how our pref works and with these investors, because I look at an investment, I should say, as, hey, how would someone who has no knowledge or never invested in real estate want to look at this deal? They hear the preferred return, explain that, and then exact nuance about the delta and what that looks like. If, it's a 5% cash on cash return, that 3% is cumulative compounding and will come back at close prior to us getting fees. And you did mention something that I wanted to just spell out once more to everyone who listens and works with us naturally or wants to work with us. And naturally, not everyone listens to every single episode where we did talk about this pref conversation and you said it, but I just want to spell this out once more. Our preferred return is cumulative compounding subject to 100% return of capital. Okay. So that all needs to occur. That 8% annually needs to occur, needs to get paid out at sale or, with cash flow over the whole process prior to Lone Star taking a lick and the waterfall upside to the deal. So I just want to explain that. And, Rob, can you maybe talk about the shortcomings or downsides of investing with sponsors who maybe aren't as sophisticated or don't have the same policy that we have, and what that could look like, and maybe how detrimental that could be if one makes, an LP investment?
Yeah, we could definitely walk through that. And also, even if these differences may not result in huge dollar differences, they are beneficial from a downside protection standpoint. And also, it is reflective of the mindset of the sponsor. And right, like a hidden fee, for example, if it's not a big fee, is not necessarily going to kill a deal. But the fact that it's hidden is the negative part about it, right? That's what you don't like to see. So if you do invest in a deal, which I wouldn't necessarily be personally opposed to this, I don't think this is a deal killer, but if you're investing in a deal which doesn't have a compounding preferred return, basically there's not really any penalty for the sponsor to not pay cash flow today versus tomorrow. However, if the preferred return compounds, if we make a distribution of 6% in year one to investors, but the preferred return is 8%, that 2% deficiency is going to accrue to the following. It's going to add basically to the capital account. And now the 8% is going to be owed on a larger base. So their preferred return snowballs and accrues and compounds, gets bigger and bigger. So again, the investor is owed more return or more dollars before we as the sponsor participate in any performance compensation. And that's really big because there should be a penalty, because there's a time value of money, and that helps with downside protection. Because if a deal, for example, is only distributing 2, 4, 5% and it's deficient, right, there should be a penalty and there should be an upside for the investors to endure that. And that upside is the compounding of their prefs that they get when they do eventually get caught up. They get caught up with more dollars than they would have otherwise. So that is big. And then when you talk about return of capital, some people may not be as familiar with what that means or the differences between an American and a European waterfall. So when you have a institutional waterfall, a European style waterfall, you would have first the preferred return is paid. Then after the preferred return is satisfied, the next step in the waterfall is to pay investors their original investment back. And then after that second step, then the final step is the share between the sponsor and the investor of the remaining distributions. And this order of operations holds true for cash flow, for refinance proceeds, and for sale proceeds. So it doesn't matter where the money's coming from out of the deal. If there's any distributions coming out of the deal, that's the order of operations. And that's why I love it so much. It puts investors first, but it's also really simple. We don't have to think, okay, because this is cash flow, we're going to split it this way. And if it's refi proceeds, we're going to split it this way, right? And that's what happens with an American style waterfall, or also known as a cash flow promote, where if it's cash flow that we're talking about, so monthly or quarterly distributions, the order of operations would be first the preferred return. So let's say, to make the example simple, let's say there's 10% cash flow being distributed. The first 8 would be to satisfy the 8% preferred return. And then we have 2% that's left over. Well, that 2% is now, it's distributable and it's subject to the waterfall. So let's say the waterfall is a 75-25 split. That means 1.5% would go to the investor. So they'd end up with 9.5% cash flow, and the sponsor would get 0.5% of the distribution, and that's their take, right? Because they get 25% of anything above 8. So that's a cash flow promote where the order of operations of the waterfall is different based on if we're talking about cash flow or if we're talking about a capital event. And like I said, I don't like this because number one, it means that the sponsor can actually get paid. Let's say there's a good year of cash flow, there's 10% cash flow. The sponsor can get paid performance compensation. But then the next year, let's say cash flow is bad at 6%. Well, they don't pay it back. There's no clawback, there's no penalty. Nothing happens. They earned that promote in the first year, but then in the next year, they just don't earn a promote. So there's no downside to them. And this is also true if not even necessarily the property underperforms, it could just be that you go from interest-only debt payments to amortizing debt payments, right? So the interest-only debt payment was 10, but then you begin to amortize and now you're only cash flowing 8. So these are just nuances where, yeah, is it a game changer to make 10% cash flow versus 9.5? No, it's not a game changer. It's not going to ruin the deal or make the deal, but it is emblematic of the overall kind of how the sponsor is treating investors and what their mindset is.
Awesome breakdown. Really meaty there and important to understand the preferred return. Speaking of preferred return, I also want people to think about this as well. When they are making an investment, there's a lot of this capital structure being placed into capital stacks, whether it be a cash and refinance and an infusion of this sort of equity. And then when you invest in deals, be wary if this sort of equity is in there and the structure and what the nuances regarding this is, because it will affect your cash flow potentially, and that is a preferred equity position, pref equity. So a lot of joint venture groups right now, there's a lot of joint venture groups, family offices, and just folks out there who want to take a pref equity position, which is effectively a more of a guaranteed the first position. It goes basically from a capital stack. You've got the debt, which is the first position. Then you'll have maybe mezzanine, depending upon if you're in there or not, or you have preferred equity in there. So preferred equity is basically you need to get a certain return on cash and then a certain amount of the upside, and that sits first before the investors get paid. So really understand the importance of pref equity and how it may or may not affect your returns as an investor. So it basically eats first. Am I explaining that correctly, Rob? Is that interpretation fair for the Rob Beardsley, the author of an incredible book discussing said topics? Did I explain that well?
Yes, that's actually a very good point that you're bringing up, because that's also a big myth about preferred returns, is the misconception or the conflation or the confusion about a preferred return versus preferred equity. So just because a deal has preferred return, which is just a partnership structure mechanism, it doesn't mean that there's subordination of an equity position. So what's subordinate to the preferred return is the sponsor's promote, but the sponsor's promote doesn't have a capital account. So it's not like somebody's putting money in the deal and their money gets paid after somebody else, but that is the case with preferred equity. So when there's preferred equity, like a family office wants to come in and put a couple million dollars into a deal, but they want to get paid before all the other investors, that would be structured as preferred equity. And then, so first, obviously, you pay the debt, then you pay the preferred equity partner. And then what's left over is for the common equity. And again, that is going to similarly, just the same, flow through the waterfall where there is highly likely to be a preferred return, right? So you have preferred equity and then you have a preferred return. So, I mean, if you live and breathe in these structures and these spreadsheets, this is all simple. But if you're hearing this for the first time, you might go, this is a lot of moving parts and this is crazy. So, like you said, just know that these things exist and you have to read the docs, and
Well,
someone has to walk.
I really want to educate people on this as well, and it's something that I'm, now a lot more seasoned and experienced and can kind of walk through this and see through these things. But when I never made a real estate investment and we were sitting at my house in Oregon and you're walking me through this for the first time, we kind of had really this conversation. This was in about August of, I want to say 2022, where we had the gentleman's trip to my family's place out there, and we were kind of going through that. But preferred equity is just a really important thing to think about, and it can really cut for you, it cut against you. When it was really interesting is that so many of these institutional equity sources kind of saw the writing on the wall that, hey, returns are actually looking like for IRRs, realistically speaking, about 13 to 14%. That doesn't really make sense when they handicap the deal with their projections to it. For them, they're like, well, am I really gonna invest in a deal with that limited upside? Or am I going to take a pref position, which eats first to get us, the returns we're kind of seeking on, which, just maybe it could be a flat 16%, but there's a lot more certainty there. And they'll basically eat that there. And then the common equity can potentially fight for the scraps because we don't think they maybe may or may not hit that return. So that is just something to think about. That was their philosophy. That was their mindset over the last, I would say, 18 months. And then for sure, we're kind of coming out of it where now there's a lot of, equity that needs to be placed from a lot of these institutional capital sources, whether it be pension funds, so on and so forth. As returns are getting wider, naturally, they want to capture more of the upside versus a limited coupon of a preferred equity position there. So just something to think about there, and just understand really when you are going to make an investment as an LP, how's the capital stack structured? You need to know it is a disclosure if that is in the equity stack, because that materially changes what's going on in the deal. So please, 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 for your own safety, for your own knowledge, understand what's going on. And also, another thing to think about is when you are making an investment, of course, a lot of people ask when they're vetting a sponsor, have you made a capital call? Okay, cool. Well, other than a capital call, have you had any pref infusions into your deal? Because maybe they didn't make a capital call, but they infused pref in the deal, which is likely going to do what? It's going to dilute the investor's equity. Okay, so really important to think about that. These are, you know, such important topics. And the biggest thing I want to talk about is this, the distinction and the jargon within the commercial real estate language that can cause you to think that you're making a good investment when in all actuality, it may not be the best investment. So we just understand the nuances there. But, you know, and just for Lone Star Capital to spell this out, a lot of people are surprised to hear this, but we've never taken preferred equity in any single of our deals in our capital stacks. So what that means is that there's debt, and then there's common equity and nothing else. So common equity means we are pari passu, shoulder to shoulder. Everyone is in there together. We collectively get paid the same. There's not a superior piece of the capital structure that needs capital structure that needs to get paid before you do, the investor. So we're really proud of that. But that doesn't mean that we may not take preferred equity at some point. And also, someone nicely asked this to me on one of our deals: would we consider pref in our deals? The answer is we have the best pref in the world if we want to take it. Rob, do you want to spell out or talk about? I don't know if we can or can't, but I was going to tee this up for you. If we were to take pref, who we would do it with? In addition to who we do it with, what our numbers look like, because it is very compelling. And then we'll go into the cases into which we might actually want to take pref in our deal and the advantages of it. And of course, if you invest in a deal like that, you would of course know. But I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, those are all really good points. And I think it's important to say that we haven't taken on pref because we haven't found the environment conducive to borrow pref. Because what pref means is basically more leverage because it's kind of like debt. It earns a fixed rate of return. But what you have to do is you have to have conviction that you can actually achieve a return in excess of the pref cost. Otherwise, why would you take it? So, well, and to answer that question, the rhetorical one there is a lot of sponsors did take on pref, even though when they didn't think the deal was that great, because it was an easier way to raise quote equity. If they could get half of the equity from pref, yeah, sure, that pref might have default rights and remedies and a fixed rate of return and negatively affect the other equity in the deal, but at least it got them half their equity done and then they could raise the rest of the equity. So those are the two main reasons why you'd borrow pref. You want to raise more equity more easily, right? You get a big chunk from a pref source. And then the other reason is if you truly think there's a ton of upside in the deal. So why share that upside with a bunch of common equity investors when you can give a fixed return to the pref? And then you and your investors that are remaining get all the upside. So to your point, 2024, we think it's going to be a fantastic year to invest. I think the opportunities are going to be fat and rich. And if that's the case, there may be opportunities to where we could be enticed to borrow pref while still, most importantly, keeping risk under control. One other thought that comes to mind as far as when it would be good to borrow pref is if you are assuming an in-place loan that is at very low leverage. The in-place loan on a deal might be accretive to assume because let's say the rate is 3%. So, oh, fantastic. I would love to assume the seller's rate at 3%, better than a 6% rate today, right? But let's say that loan is only 40, 50% leverage. You might want to take more leverage than 50, and you might want to use pref to gross up your leverage to 70 or whatever the case may be. So that could be another instance to use pref. So, and as far as our pref partner, yeah, I'd rather not share that at this point. I mean, we haven't closed, but yeah, I mean, it pays to have good relationships, good reputation, and obviously good people advocating on your behalf, specifically Nate Lowy, who's our debt broker. So he's out in the market knows exactly what's going on and knows who the best players are for us to be working with on the debt side, and that includes preferred equity.
You want to talk about, or is it hush hush for the moment as to our tentative potential terms? Obviously, things are fluid and can change, but can you share that, or is it a little shh, Lone Star secret?
We could share that. I mean, yeah, I would say the best pref terms out there generally available, which is what we would be interested in, would be like something like a 6 or 7% current pay requirement, which means that's kind of the interest rate that you owe on the pref every single month. So it might be 6 or 7%. And then there's an additional 7% that accrues every year. So if you have pref borrowed for 5 years and you have to pay it back, that 7% accrues every single year. So when you pay off that pref, let's say it's $1 million of pref, you're not just going to pay the $1 million back after 5 years. You're going to owe $1 million plus the seven every single year. So 7 times 5, 35, you're going to have to pay them back $1,350,000. So pref's no joke. I mean, but at the end of the day, if it's, let's say, 6 and 7, that's 13%. A 13% fixed rate of return is not bad when you blend it across the entire capital stack with the debt plus pref. So, yeah, there's a time and place.
And you know, the reason why this is important and I bring this up is because if we get a deal that we're confident that is going to be at least an 18% or 17% IRR with a very high level of predictability and certainty, well, that's a massive overflow and waterfall once you get past the 13 or 14% preferred return that is 100%, because there's, you know, depending upon the capital structure there. You know, you get all the upside. There's no waterfall there. So something to think about on that return. And we've gone into the weeds here, as we typically do, and into tangents with regards to preferred return. And then we also gave you a little preferred equity bonus. A lot of people ask us as well for resources and what we like to do and what we'd like to listen to help educate us.
Let me
And I want to,
before, sorry about that. Let me
you're good.
actually also
Closing thought.
closing thought.
See, this is what happens when I don't ask for a closing thought.
I know, I
I get
know.
called out for it. Like, no, just go to the next topic. And
It's
then you
all
have such a
good.
good
It's
idea.
all
You
good.
have to
You
stop
were
me.
actually
So I love it.
you're putting together such a nice transition there, but
Thank you.
I had to jump in here with, like you said, we got into the weeds. This stuff is definitely complicated. So what some people started doing, and a lot of people do this, is they don't have a preferred return in their deal structure. So, and that can appeal to an investor who heard us say all that, and they go, "That's all complicated." And then comes in a knight in shining armor, and goes, "Oh, well, just invest in my deal. It doesn't have any of that garbage. It's just a straight split." And the investor goes, "Oh, I can wrap my head around that. That's great." And so these straight split deals, they won't have a pref. And so every dollar that is distributed out of the deal is just straight up split 80-20. And so 20% goes right off the top to the sponsor. So the sponsor's performance comp is not subordinate to any sort of minimum return metric. So this is horrible. And I advise everyone to run in the opposite direction of any deal that doesn't have a preferred return, because it's so disadvantageous and not market. Why would you do that when there's hundreds of other people you can invest with that offer a much more favorable structure? And if you're modeling out the difference, it might not be a big difference in a base case model scenario as far as what you as the investor are going to get in returns, but model the downside scenario. And that's where it comes into play, because in the rosy scenario, everything's fine. But let's say a deal really doesn't go the way you hoped. And instead of it being a 15% return, let's say it's only an 8. Well, guess what? If it's an 8% return and the sponsor gets 20% straight up, well, they're going to take 20% of the 8 available, and you're going to be left with whatever the math works out there, 7, 6, whatever. If there's an 8% preferred return and the deal's an 8, guess what? The investors get 8 and the sponsor gets nothing, just like it should be. We should not get paid if we underperform. So that's my rant there about preferred return nuances, and one nuance being it doesn't even exist in the deal at all.
So we have a very good friend, one of our best friends, We keep actually alluding to him, and I think he'll actually be here on the show potentially for our Sedona edition. We'll have a round robin
Correct.
episode, so we're going to tease that we'll be in Sedona. Not that we're wanting to meet up with any of you who listen to the show. That's an us time mastermind and collaboration. But he's in the weeds now and looking for other operators to diversify in asset classes. And he's kind of taking a situation where he might be kind of a quasi family office investing, you know, the family's money and whatnot, and obviously his own. And he's got the finance background and whatnot. And we joke and we kind of trade notes because naturally he knows, of course, we're in the business, so we know what market looks like. And just a big PSA for anyone, just this is for legitimately, this is a public safety announcement. All right. A PSA here. If you are getting not market offering terms like bizarre six and sevens or, you know, 6% for return and then a 60-40 split, or you're not getting an 8 or 9% for return with like a 70-90, something like that, that's problematic. Okay. That's not market rate. So please just know that. And please know that if you're working with a good sponsor, they need to be competitive because they're obviously trying to compete with other legitimate people, not, you know, unsophisticated investors. So please just know that good groups are kind of like us. We have an 8% preferred return just for our Class A shares. It's an 8% preferred return, a 70-30 split to 15% and 50-50 for 50K to $499,000. And then for 500K and above, it's a 9% preferred return, a 70-30 split with no additional hurdle. Cumulative and compounding, as we just alluded to. Please just note that if it's not something in that ballpark, you may be working with someone who is unsophisticated or someone I just wouldn't want to work with personally if they don't have a normal structure like that in there. That's kind of a red flag.
Yeah, it is a red flag because it's them telling you that they specifically want to work with investors, sorry.
Who are stupid or
Yes.
that don't know left from right, which basically
I
they're
was going to say
insulting your.
something a little more diplomatic, but that's correct. It's
They think you're
basically like,
stupid.
we're hoping that you don't know any better, so you're
And
going
you're
to
not
invest with
shopping.
us and we're going to charge you a 40% promote over a 6% pref, and that's, don't worry about it. And that's a red flag because it speaks to everything else in their operation, right? Like the reason why Grant Cardone gets a lot of hate
I
is
was just
because
about to say, yeah, someone who has a certain X associated with them has some. To my understanding, some pretty heinous fee associations.
right. So like let's use Grant Cardone as an example. The reason why he has a poor reputation is because he specifically targets
Allegedly.
unsophisticated investors,
Allegedly.
allegedly
Come
unsophisticated
on.
investors, right? He's targeting people that write small checks. That's why his minimum is like $1,000, right? Because
Ugh.
people who don't are not investment professionals or are not accredited investors, they are the ones that are going to fall prey to investing in worse than market terms. And this is, like I said, it's a red flag because it speaks to the overall who the sponsor is. Like we specifically shoot ourselves in the foot by wanting to work with the smartest investors. Because if we work with the smartest investors, guess what? They know what's up and what's down, and they're going to call us out and they're going to make us better, and they're not going to let us get away with charging a 4% acquisition fee. And so it shoots us ourselves in the foot, but it's what we want to do, it's what we like, and we want to work with smart people. And we want to be better and we want to treat people fairly and have long-term relationships. Because guess what? You know, it's a really uncomfortable concept is let's say that quote unquote unsophisticated investor or stupid investor, let's say they educate themselves and one day become a smart investor. They're going to be on some investment forum, which I lurk myself and where they talk about other sponsors and stuff. And they're going to say, yeah, well, I invested in so and so before I knew anything. And now that I know something, I really regret investing in that partnership and that deal. And I don't think, you know, now they're saying bad things to other smart people and it's no good. So it's just not worth it in the long run. But that's what that's showing. And then, like to use the Grant Cardone example, again, allegedly, right? This sort of position and idea that they take, which is high fees and poor terms and targeting unsophisticated investors, well, it's also allegedly looking like they have engaged in some sort of scheme where they overcharge the investors for the purchase price of the property. So let's say Grant's
Oh my
company,
God, this
allegedly,
actually
allegedly.
allegedly I'll throw up if this is the case, and it makes me sick allegedly if this is the case.
Yes. So allegedly, they're putting properties under contract for 100 million, and then they package up the deal and they put a pitch deck together. But then when they go to their investors, they say, yeah, we're buying this deal for 112 million, and you're going to pay us. So the deal is 112 million.
So it's like wholesaling a deal back to the invest, allegedly wholesaling a deal back to the investors. And then on top of the wholesale to the investors, then they charge an acquisition fee that's probably higher than market, probably a higher property management fee, construction fee, allegedly all associated there. So if that's the case, that just makes our life easier because we don't have that, but also kind of stains the business too, to a certain extent. So I don't, it just is what it is. I mean, I don't think any super uber sophisticated people are investing with Grant Cardone. I don't think anyone who is at the IMN Laguna Beach event, who is in control of billion-dollar discretionary funds from pensions and such, are putting their money there. I could be wrong, but it's pretty alarming if that's true. I hope it's not true. I like the book "Sell or Be Sold" by Grant Cardone. I genuinely like his messaging as well. I think it's more positive than not. I think it does bring some good to the world. So I'm not a Grant Cardone hater by any means. I really hope this is not true. But these are some of the information and sources we've seen on the internet, which could be true, could be false. There's obviously a less than desirable lawsuit going on right now with the T-Mobile former CEO of T-Mobile there. And he wants to bring him down, and Grant is not letting it go. So there'll be something in court. But it is interesting. If he is doing a 506Bs or Cs, well, if he's doing a 506C, then it's for only folks who are sophisticated investors. There's only 35 of those allowed for one individual investment. So I'd be curious to know if he's going over that accreditation because there's only so many of them. And that is a easy SEC violation that could be found. Like that, if they really audit the investors there, especially, and this is why we have a minimum of $50,000, because $50,000 is not an insignificant amount of money. You probably are more sophisticated if that's the case. But you know, $1,000 checks. Well, let's say if you've got 35 or you know, non-accredited investors that are investing in a 506B that is open to non-accredited but sophisticated investors, well, you're going to run out of those slots very quickly. So that's just hard to think about why you'd even let a $1,000 check into a single deal to start with, period.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think that their funds are Reg A funds, which are not Reg D offerings. So 506B and 506C exemptions fall under the Reg D offering. I believe they have a Reg A offering, which allows for it's way harder to get. It takes a lot more work to get through the SEC, but I think it allows you to have 1,000 investors and you can go to the public and be unaccredited and all this good
Does
stuff.
it
So
kind of make it like a REIT then almost?
it's like a, yeah, exactly. It's like a very generic investment product for the public. And yeah, you have to structure it as a fund like that for him because doing deal by deal raises with $1,000 minimums would be, I mean, $1,000 in general is just crazy.
I would pull my hair out if I had to speak to that just for that amount of equity. With all due respect to anyone who is in that situation, we encourage everyone to invest in real estate. I think about $1,000 to invest, I would invest it back into myself and into education and enrichment to make more money as opposed to throwing that into something there. But as I said, this is all alleged. We don't hope that any of this is the case. We're not making any claims here. Just put the legal hat on, put the legal hat off, onto more fun topics. And that is the Frozen webinar by one of our top resources and people that we like to listen to a lot, James Eng. So he had a topic of it was frozen, and it was kind of in reference to the market and the lack of transaction volume over the last, you know, I guess what, 16 months roughly, would you say it's fair? So, and he actually did a very nice comprehensive deep dive, showed some really cool graphs with cap rates and stuff. You know, with where they were at and in kind of the parts of the cycle recently. But it was kind of funny because it just snowed recently in Dallas. And then he said, well, just like Dallas snow, it does not last long. What would cause the defrosting of this kind of slow and colder market? And it is the 155,000 1,000 units coming up with debt maturities, which will end the frozen market. So I liked that. We do have in 2024, 155 units, I believe, just in Texas alone that have maturity. That's not just, deals that want to get traded early. So that could really shake up and loosen up the market a bit to have velocity increase here. Naturally, will not be like the year of 2021, but more to normalcy would be incredible. Did you have any other comments you wanted to add to the frozen webinar? Any takeaways?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, good content as always from James. Love his webinars. The counter argument I have with this idea that things are going to unfreeze so simply because we have this wall of maturities coming is I don't think that a maturity necessarily results in a transaction because with I think a maturity is not the way that a maturity is going to be worked out a lot of the time is an extension. If a property is in trouble, but the owner is still got their head in the game and they don't want to give up, if they give up, then they're just going to give the keys back to the lender. The lender's most likely going to sell the property. That's a transaction. But if the owner's got their head in the game and they have a maturity and they're current on the loan, they're going to go back to the lender most likely and say, "Hey, Mr. Lender, I'm in a bind. I've been working really hard to pay your loan. Can we just keep this going?" Or, "Hey, can we keep this going? But I can't keep paying the full payment. Can we pay half and I'll accrue the rest?" Or something like that. And so there's just a negotiation that takes place there. And so I think that's going to happen a lot, which delays and prolongs this r reckoning that has to happen. These things have to be reckoned, but it doesn't all have to happen at once and all upon maturity, because these maturities can get pushed out, they can get spread out, they can extend and pretend. But also, given that James is a debt broker, right? He's in the business of brokering loans. He's also talking about the unfreezing of the lending market as well. And so that is true. I mean, if you have a maturity coming and you have the opportunity to refi, well, you're most likely going to go ahead and refi rather than try to negotiate with the lender. Because if you're on a bridge loan, for example, your interest rate today might be 9%, and you could refi to fixed rate debt at about 6%. And that represents a very large savings. But the big question is, can you do it? Because as you know, if you are on a bridge loan that's high leverage, you can't go to Fannie and Freddie and get the same loan amount at that lower interest rate. They'll give you a loan, but it'll be at, let's say, if the existing loan is 50 million, they might be willing to give you a loan at 40 million. And that's where you have a gap. Now you have a $10 million gap that has to be solved either through not going forward with the transaction, making a capital call, or getting preferred equity.
Pref infusion. This is where I didn't make a capital call, but I infused pref and effectively had the same result nonetheless. It may be actually a more negative impact than you would think by, making and meeting a capital call. Another interesting thing that James spoke about in the webinar, which is not necessarily surprising, he's been in the business since 2015, but he said this is the first time I've seen loans go down in his career. So basically, meaning the properties are evaporating in value. So thought that was interesting. Did you have any other comments regarding it? I just obviously love how he puts it together. And we'll probably put the link there. But any final thoughts on that subject?
No. Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for all these things that we've been talking about to play out and hopefully come true. I am getting maybe impatient or changing my thoughts on how, like we talked about, how soon and how long the opportunity is in the market. So, yeah, we'll just have to see, and looking forward to James's next piece of content so we can see where we're at.
Content makes content because he helps us with our content. And speaking of which, I was in the process of emailing him to invite him to Fun Friday. So hopefully he'll be making an appearance as he is a valued member of our resource list, which folks have asked for. So happy to provide that, and we'll keep providing information that we're absorbing. Also, I want to get a book for February, so we'll have to put that out next week. Nonetheless, that brings me to IMN Laguna Beach, which is the private equity forum. IMN has kind of a mixed bag of conferences, in the sense of levels to them. They kind of come all over into major cities. I would say that without any doubt at all, IMN Laguna Beach was incredibly valuable and was a paradigm shifter for me personally. So this was the Laguna Beach event. There's IMN or Newport, but that's in Rhode Island for the California West Coast people. There's Newport, Rhode Island, Newport Beach, California, which is right below Laguna, so it's slightly confusing, but I had a total paradigm shift while I was there, Rob. And I'll say this, I mean, you heard me calling you right after these meetings where we were speaking with, or I was speaking with and meeting with people that I never met before. These are more of the joint venture JV equity folks, check size anywhere from $8 to $30 million. And there is so much money waiting to get deployed from all the capital sources. You know, they have to, you know, return money there. They've got to invest in deals because they are owing pref like we would if money is not deployed. And it just really made me think that if you're an operator, whatever it may be, and you know, not that I'm looking to help my competition, but I will just say this, if you're ever thinking that there's not a lot of money out there or raising is tough, you go to an event like this and you could just feel, smell, and hear all the money, all the deals being made, all the relationships being built, forged, and touched up upon. And it was just a paradigm shift for me because the amount of money in the room, I don't think I've ever been, maybe I have, I just wasn't as aware of it because I was really obviously have to have having to set everything up and you know find my way through the event with these, you know, incredibly high level capital partners. It was just so inspiring to be in that room. And I'm even more grateful to continue next step conversations with some of these new partners that we've met that will hopefully find their way into our capital stack and to be future partners, and then to also do NMHC next week. But it was just very inspiring. It was eye-opening for me, and it made me really think about RN having, you know, wanting to level up in regards to doing more programmatic joint venture relationships. Programmatic meaning recurring deals where, you know, a group gets comfortable with us, they've gone through the due diligence process, and it's an easy yes or no for them to give us equity. It's not a, hey, well, we got to go through the relationship making. It's, hey, the relationship's formed. We've done a deal here, and then we do there, you know, Q1 to Q2, Q3, Q4 kind of thing. Just a recurring, you know, flow of opportunities there. And it was just very inspiring to be around that. And then what was really cool was following that, we got a couple of calls from JV partners we're working on wanting to invest in our deals, but us having to tell them kindly that we don't have any space in them. So this has been my biggest obsession of late is thinking about how do we crack this code? How do we get these people on our capital stack? And I think we're there. And it's going to be now down to Brad and you to find the great opportunities for me to take copious diligent notes to pair up the deal with the capital person and for us to find what these people want to do. And to be top flight partners to make them feel comfortable with investing with us. So everything we're doing is kind of led up to this point with putting the infrastructure and systems in place to attract said people. But we're just right there. I'm so inspired. I'm so excited. I truly wake up every single day with such a purpose, such a mission to get this. It's like my enthusiasm for the business has really just tripled seemingly. Not that it was ever low, but like recently, like I'm so fixated and obsessed on this mission and this quest to get it. It's just palpable. You know, it's just awesome. So turn it back over to you to see if you have any extra feedback.
Yeah, we're at the right place at the right time. We built ourselves up to have the track record, the infrastructure, the reputation, the ability to build these relationships credibly. And like you said, we're right there. The time is right. And also, aside from us, it's now the right time in the market. Because while
Yes.
we were building these relationships in years past, and we've had some success with attracting these sorts of investors, a lot of these investors were just simply on the sideline, or like you said earlier, they pivoted to putting out preferred equity because they didn't have conviction in taking last dollar risk and wanting to go for the upside home run. Instead, they were happy hitting singles and doubles and making a fixed rate of return as preferred equity. So the opportunity in the market was just very tight. And now we're at a point where a lot of these JV groups are waiting and ready to get back in. And unfortunately, no matter how smart you are or what type of capital you are, We're all human and we have emotions. And so the emotionality of markets causes us to invest when it's too late. Now, not saying we're going to miss the opportunity. I'm saying that people generally jump back in too late. And now is the time. Right now is the time. The deals are the most attractive because we're seeing it on the ground. There's very little competition. Brokers are calling us and saying, please take a look at this deal. We have nobody else at the table. And that's when you're going to be able to get the best price. So the time is now, but the problem is, and I'd be curious to get your feedback from the conversations that you had at Laguna Beach with these high-level discretionary funds and private equity firms and family offices as to their temperature, because the feeling that I'm getting is investors are still waiting for the all-clear sign to jump back in.
So before they were looking for a unicorn, just like you would, just like I would. If a unicorn was for sale, I would bet my house on it because you'd want to buy the unicorn deal, the unique deal, the diamond in, a rough, the needle in the haystack. And that was kind of what they were open to doing before. As I said, all these shops were, we'll look at a deal, but it was more of a perfunctory task than a actual, hey, I want to deploy some money into this deal right now. And the interesting thought to this was in 2021, someone from a big, big firm who has two funds, they've got $1 billion they need to deploy in the next 2 years. They're like, listen, it was miserable in 2021. The market was too hot and sponsors were too cocky about taking equity and kind of wrote us off and you were unreasonable on the terms. Like, we're reasonable people here, like we think. And they were just very distasted by the market like that. So I thought that was a very interesting premise there. But I would definitely say that there's, of course, a lot of people that are in the prep position that still want to be there, but will look for deals with, 20% deal level IRR, which frankly, the two deals that we're looking at right now that are in our control are north of that, which is exciting. So we're right on the money there. But I definitely think that there is money out there to be had, and there are equity is burning a hole in some people's pockets because they need to have a return on that. So we just got a call from two people that went out of their way to reach out to give us money or try to on deals. Unfortunately, we didn't have a tranche big enough for them. So it's just really exciting that that's there. But I think we're right there and the green light's about to hit go. And I think second half of this year, money's about to be flying. And what gets me so excited is the fact that we don't have to look in the rear view. We get to look forward. We get to play offense. We get to be aggressive because we don't have to answer the questions or deal with, portfolio, as you call it, legacy issues. So we're just so primed and ready to go to really crush. And I think a big reason as to why we didn't get JV equity before is two things: is we didn't have enough track record of full cycle stories. We hadn't been through a recession. Property management team is really young. Now it's, year three of property management. And I think personally, don't take this the wrong way, we're gonna laugh at this. I also think they looked at you and probably thought you looked a little too young. Now you not say you look old now, but you've been in the business now for 5, 6 years. That's not nothing. And not say I look like an old man here, but I am getting some grays. The business is aging me. If you see them over here as well, I'm starting to find them. But nevertheless, I think we're just a little bit older, a lot more wiser, and we're better positioned than ever to be in receipt of what they're seeking and to check their boxes to make them feel comfortable. And I also feel now more than ever fully confident and comfortable going up to the biggest equity groups in the world. If it's Starwood, if it's DRA, Brasa, you name it, PPR, whatever it is, we have relationships with these people, of course, but going to any firm, feeling like not entitled for it, but we are qualified. We are what they're looking for, and we are a mutually beneficial fit, not like they're doing us a favor. And knowing that and feeling that and presenting that and packaging that together does make a difference. So I'm just thrilled. My excitement level, as you said, has never been higher. And I'm on a mission right now, and it's just incredible.
I love all those sentiments, and it's you can't just snap your fingers or blink and build that mindset overnight. You actually have to have the real world experience and the true relationships. Like you said, if you have a relationship with a multi-billion dollar private equity firm already, then it gives you the confidence to meet a new one and say, well, yeah, I've been here before. I know what I'm doing, and we have a relationship similar to this, so we know how to conduct ourselves. And obviously, we're always learning, and we're humble, and we're willing to learn. And that's one of the exciting parts about partnering with institutional capital is you basically get someone to pay, give you money and pay you fees to be your mentor because they've done billions of dollars of deals. They're smarter than you, right? And so this, to me, it's such an exciting thing. And also, when we talk about all this and get excited, I don't want people to misconstrue that we're closing our doors on retail investors. That remains a big focus of ours, and we never want to close that door. We think that it's a fabulous business and a great thing to build these relationships with individual investors and to have investors as small as 50K a check. And we love the individual investors as much as we love chasing the JV. We think there's a place for them in every capital stack, frankly.
You just took the words out of my mouth and or said something that I always have to say because so many people ask, well, does Rob even take, non-JV equity or institutional equity? The answer is yes. We do take, all sorts of folks in the capital stack. That's common equity, of course, as we alluded to earlier. But we also, for the record, have worked with several institutional partners from an institutional equity perspective, just to name two off the back, Park Row Equity in Long Island, and then Flagship Capital in Houston. Two great friends and partners there that we look to do more deals with. We're obviously doing a deal with one of them right now. But just from a reference perspective, we have that there, which is great. And I thought a very interesting comment that was made, kind of not in passing per se, but it was just a And this is why you spend the big bucks to go to the elite conferences. A member of one of the big firms that I got to meet with, he's like, yeah, I was like, out of curiosity, because I'm just infatuated with this topic right now. I was like, out of curiosity, how does a group like us, find deals? Like, we do good deals, like, and we're not doing anything that, you're probably not saying yes to. He's like, the funniest thing you should say that is just actually having a frame of reference and a legitimate point where you met, not just like a cold email, because like so much can get lost. So it's so valuable. Like somewhere where, hey, you have your phone number, you've had multiple conversations with them, you've met them somewhere, you can stamp a place and time. Like, oh, I met Craig Grother with Lone Star Capital at IMN Laguna. He's a real person, seemed hopefully like a with it guy and a nice gentleman. I remember him. I can take their deal more seriously as opposed to, oh, yeah, here's a cold email. How the heck do I know you? So this segues into the next conversation, which is conferences and strategies, which is, our strategy, be very intentional with regards to setting appointments for, as I said, in regards to NMHC, which is airing in the Monday of NMHC. Our schedule is completely full, basically. We have no more overlapping times together, which is exciting. We've got about 25 meetings, I think. I don't have to count. All massive joint venture equity shops, which is crazy. This lineup is stacked. This is like an all-star lineup up for equity. I really feel like this is the Pro Bowl, so to speak. So that's awesome. So that's just so fun. And as I said, conferences we want to go to. I just attended IMN in Laguna. We're going to NMHC. We got BEC coming up. We got Raise Fest before BEC. And then we've got, I think we're going to do, I might do the fundamental event in Phoenix. Shout out to the founders there. And then I'm going to do obviously the best event of the year, the Lone Star Summit, of course, Ascent in Miami. And then, oh, bonus, IMN
Newport.
Newport, Rhode Island. And if you can think of anything else that would be of use for me to attend, I'm all ears. But I'm just excited and I'm really have a newfound purpose and a reason to even wake up extra earlier to start the day because it's just so much fun seeing the emails trickle in and whatnot. So it's just that level right now of excitement and anticipation for what's to come here in the new year. So I want to stay present, but that's kind of the conferences we're going to. And we want to pay for the higher ticket ones because typically speaking, that's where the big money is. At this point, we have so many people and we want to keep on more people that are at 500K to $2 million tranche level, but I also wanted to go big game hunting and big game fishing and, catch the big one. So that's what those higher level ticket events typically have.
Yeah, I can remember when I was in Dubai last year and we actually got the thumbs up on a big equity partner, if you remember this point in time or this story. And I remember I was in my Airbnb and it's like 1 a.m. Dubai time because it's way, way forward. And I remember getting the phone call and locking in the terms and getting that JV equity partner signed up, and I was super excited and kind of jumping around the living room and stuff. It is big game hunting is exciting, and it's fun to negotiate and structure these big deals and stuff. So yeah, that's all great. And also, you just rattled off a lot of great conferences. I think conferences are a big risk because they take a lot of time, they take a lot of money, and I would say that the time is the bigger one. So they can be really, really valuable, right? You just went to Laguna IMN and came away with some great relationships and some nuggets. And so that's valuable. But I've been to conferences where I've shown up, flew, hotel, ticket, time, and I walked away with really nothing to show for it. So
A
that
goose
is,
egg.
yeah, that's not what you want. So we need to be very careful with our time, as always. And so we've been fortunate to have friends of the show and partners refer us to certain events and say, hey, this is a must-go event and whatnot. So if you're listening and you want to shoot us some event recommendations, we're all ears. But we definitely want to be conscientious with our time and divide and conquer and stuff. So yeah, and
And you
also
know how. Okay, you
go
go.
ahead. I was
No,
going to
you
say,
go.
to your point, you want that frame of reference to meet somebody. For me, one of my nightmare ideas or nightmare scenarios is you spend all this time and effort to meet someone and build a relationship, and then you let it go stale, and then you email them some months
Oh.
later and they go, who are you? So that's why it's so important. If you are going to make this investment of time and money and energy, you need to back it up with follow-up. Follow-up is the key. And so that's why, just to peel back the curtain a bit, when we meet a new potential investor or partner, we in our database, we tag them as new equity. And that tag sits there as a reminder to us that, hey, this is a new relationship. It needs to be treated as such, it needs to get that extra care and attention. And we need to shorten the time between interactions. If you have a long-term partner or friend, right? Like a best friend from childhood, you could pick up the phone right now and you could have a phone call and pick up like right where you left off, right? Like a high school friend, you could just lock right back into that after 10 years. But if you have a new relationship, you can't just kind of, you need to give
Not
it
plug and
that
play like that.
extra. Yeah, it's not plug and play. So you want to go to dinner, have a follow-up Zoom call, like fly to their city and meet with them again. And so these are things that we need to really make happen rather than, and I don't know if I said this in the show before, but I was obsessed previously with growing our email list as much as possible. I want to meet everyone, shake every hand, hand out business cards. And it's a vanity metric. I want to grow the email list and get the biggest database in the world of investors, right? But
And
does
it's
that really
so
serve you?
funny. And it's so funny. We're like, no, we want the other side. We want to go. And that's the mile wide, inch deep versus a mile deep, right? So we want to get very strategic and cut out people we're sending emails to if we're not getting a good response or there's not a philosophical fit. Or if we just feel like, hey, they think they're too good for us, which happens, and maybe they are, and maybe they're smarter than us, but we don't want to send people emails and deals if that's how they feel about us. We'd rather have be with people who are excited when we call them, excited when we have a deal, and legitimately are looking to transact. We want motivated people we're sending emails to. We don't want to just meet with someone to meet and force a square peg in a round hole, as the age-old adage goes. We want to make sure that we are spending our time and buttering the bread that deserves to be buttered, and what wants to, get schmoozed by us and get taken out by us. And those people are making themselves very, available for us. And it's just right there. It's for the taking. And I'm just absolutely thrilled for, what's to come to close out this year, the new equity partners that come up. And just as I said, from a strategy perspective, it's all about meetings. I am not going willy-nilly through conference hall hoping to bump into someone. I'm stalking people on LinkedIn. I'm looking at people's description. I'm sending very strategic and intentional language to people, specifically stating what I am and what I am looking for, and if you are a fit. So, meaning, hey, my name's Craig. I work with Lone Star Capital. We're a Texas-focused multifamily owner-operator buying workforce Texas housing, multifamily housing, looking for JV and LP equity. Let me know if it'd be a good time to fit. And these are, hey, yes, we're a good fit, or oh, you know what, we're actually not. Sometimes the language on the websites makes it confusing. So I'm very strategic and intentional about making sure that I'm setting qualified appointments and letting people know exactly who I am and what I'm doing. I don't have a second or time to waste, and I don't want to be lingering the halls, hearing about you pitching me down something I don't care about. So, and vice versa.
Correct. Yes. So
Yeah.
all good stuff. Definitely exciting times. And yeah, just a lot of good growth coming ahead. And obviously we don't want to grow too fast because we want to stay sane and not have things break. But definitely our ambitions are running high.
Exactly. And I also think about this too, is the consistent nature of getting, as they call it in the biz, programmatic relationships going, where people, give us check after check after check, where they feel comfortable with us, is so crucial. And I think on Fun Friday, my goal, on top of having the incredible fund managers that we worked with, new and old partners, also going to be having more institutional relationships there to really spotlight them and to kind of go through what they're looking for. And of course, selfishly, develop more rapport and a deeper and more meaningful relationship with them. Because at the end of the day, this is a relationship business. The more time and energy and money we can spend with each other, the better our relationship becomes. Moving on to the offsite you and Kent had. I think we've got about 15 minutes left. I don't want to run you right to the end. But if you want to just talk about the offsite, maybe some things that you went over and the importance of running an offsite when you get to a firm of our scale and what is typically needing to be accomplished.
Yeah, so our offsites are quarterly, and what that means is Kent and myself, as the founders of Lone Star, we go offsite. We get out of the office every single quarter, and we prepare for these day-long, night-long meetings in advance. So basically, in anticipation of an offsite meeting, we'll just start collecting our notes and discussion points, which, if there's something pressing, obviously we can just walk down the hall and have a meeting ad hoc, but if it can wait, then we can just put it on the offsite agenda. So then when we show up to offsite, it's like, all right, you've got your agenda, I've got my agenda, we've got our agenda, let's talk. And we just spend a lot of time just hashing things out, brainstorming, talking through strategy. And the important thing, as people can understand and resonate with, it's working on the business, not in the business. So we do our best to avoid working on our emails and the day-to-day flow of work responsibilities. And we just instead try to focus on the bigger picture. What are our goals? How do we achieve them? What are the big projects that we need to achieve for the quarter? It's also nice to look back and say, okay, what were the wins from last quarter? What went well? What didn't go well? What new policies do we want to implement? Who do we need to hire? And how can we best achieve our goals? And to me, that's really, really exciting. It feels, when I'm doing stuff like that, it feels like I'm cheating. It feels like I'm not working because I enjoy it so much. It's work, obviously, but it feels like, wow, is this actually work? Like, I make money by doing this because it's so fun to strategize and think in this way.
That's how I feel about conferences. And I get really anxious, by the way. I didn't say this, but conferences, I get very anxious if I'm not being 100% productive because it's a big time spent away. If I'm gone, that means there's emails not being answered to, and that means I'm not giving a first class service. So it does eat away at my mental internal clock. If you don't have urgency, or if you're not hiring someone with urgency, you made a bad hire. I have such a high level of scarcity and urgency just with how I'm kind of wired. Maybe it's my dad who would yell at me if I wasn't 5 minutes early, but urgency, urgency, urgency. So, but that's awesome that you guys collaborate about what you want. You go through your agenda, Kent goes through his agenda. My question to you is, who goes over the hidden agenda?
The hidden
That
agenda. Yeah, well,
would be my role probably if I was there, and nothing would get done if I was there, probably considering how disruptive I can
I
be from time to
really
time.
appreciate that. I think I only received one phone call from you yesterday. So that was actually very nice.
Yes. But no one went through the hidden agenda. There's no secret document that you went through.
Well, so we do actually we do have a secret document, as a matter of fact. So when we produce our offsite documents, which I know we didn't do for the last couple because I just either I'm lazy or I just don't feel like there's enough really to share with the team. But we do have some hidden agendas. We do have a document that we share with the team, and then we have a little private document that we don't share with the team. So,
I imagine it could be a little colorful.
no, it's nothing crazy. But, obviously, as without even being like nefarious or talking about it's just you, as a leader, you do need to be careful about what you're sharing because, frankly, not everyone needs to know everything because it could distract, it could cause unnecessary panic, or what I mean, not to say there's anything to panic about, but it just as an example, it's not like oh, you're trying to hide things. There's actually strategic reasons why you might want to say, okay, well, we don't want to distract the team by this project, so let's plan to announce and unroll like roll out this project in Q2 instead of Q1 or something like that.
Right, for instance, probably Q3, the biggest, hidden agenda item was probably going to be my haircut, which has gotten a lot better. It was not professional before. We've of course since made it professional and JV equity approved and
Yes.
institutional equity approved. So I imagine something of that nature was likely on the hidden agenda that was not probably sent out to everyone out of respect to me, but you of course stood on that business and made sure that it was addressed accordingly. So I'm sure it's things of that nature, maybe dress code and office policy, stuff like that, hirings. I don't want to say the
Yes.
other word because I don't like to talk about that, but all, employment and things of that nature probably spins off of and goes to that meeting. I'm sure there's some spirited debates from time to time, some philosophical disalignments or full alignments, which is great. The beautiful thing is you and Kent have such an incredible, cohesive, compatible, yin and yang working relationship that is just very fruitful. And obviously, it's created the success that we have and the success that we will have in the future, which is great.
Yes, we are very, very, very blessed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rare for us to disagree, and even if we do, it's very respectful and it's no problem. So it's really great.
Well, you're blessed. Kent's blessed. I'm blessed. And you could be blessed too if you invest in our newest offering there, Inspire in San Antonio. If you're a capital raiser looking to raise equity for any of our deals and partner with us, learn more about the fund of fund program or 1031 exchanging into our deals. My email, craig@lscre.com. If you have any questions for me, let me know. You have my email. We hope to see you in person at an event, perhaps. Message me, email me. Maybe we'll go through etiquette as to how to message me to get on my calendar or not, because we had a bit of a snafu recently that I didn't get into today. I don't know how I want to address it. Maybe it's a little bit of a teaser, but if you want to get blessed, like me, like Rob, like Ken, and the team, reach out to me. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.